The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Michael Fosberg was in his early 30s when his mother and stepfather got divorced. He got angry and sad and then curious.
I never even bothered to ask her in all these years past what had happened to my biological father who had disappeared from my sight and memory at the impressionably tender age of two, a man whose image had been thoroughly buried in my mother's tech memory vaults. I went from losing dad number two to not knowing dad number one to the future, a remote possibility of acquiring a dad number three at the time. I was going through my own personal hell.
That's a clip from Incognito. It's a one-man play about Fosberg's discovery that after growing up in a middle-class white family, his biological father was black. The play raises questions of race and identity at a time when protests over the deaths of unarmed African Americans and Black Lives Matter are fueling what some are calling a new civil rights movement. Fosberg is performing Incognito this Sunday at East West University in Chicago to benefit Literature for All of Us. It's a program for under-resourced kids and adults in the Chicago area. And Michael Fosberg, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. It's good to speak with you.
Well, so your mother's white, Armenian American. Your stepfather is white. Did you grow up assuming your biological father was white as well?
Yeah, yes, I did.
No reason to question that.
No, there wasn't anything. Although, during my childhood, my high school years in particular, I was very attracted to African-American people, African-American culture. I jokingly referred to it in the play about owning all of James Brown's records on vinyl and being able to recite all Richard Pryor routines verbatim. But there wasn't anything in my immediate family to suggest that I was anything different than what they were. So.
Well, it was a girlfriend, I guess, who encouraged you to contact your biological father, who you called. So what did he tell you? How did he raise this?
Yeah, so we're going along in the phone call and sort of trying to wrap our heads around, our arms around the fact that, you know, I'm your son, you're my father. Wow, this is crazy. And then out of the blue, I mean, completely out of the blue, he says to me, you know, son, there's a couple of things you should know. I'm sure your mother's never told you. And of course, I'm like, well, aside from not telling me about you, you know, what else could there be? And the first thing he says is, well, you know, I want you to know that no matter what you thought happened or what you were told or what you assumed, I've always loved you and thought of you a lot, which was, you know, I was just so elated to hear that from my father for the first time telling me he loved me. And then he says, there's one other thing I'm sure your mother's never told you. And there was this pause and he says, I'm African American.
Wow.
And that was sort of like, that was, you know, that was the, like, wait, did I just hear that correctly? What just went by? And I remember I was living in a tiny rent-controlled apartment in the Santa Monica area in Southern California, and I remember it was probably about the size of a walk-in closet, the whole apartment. And there was a mirror next to me, and I kind of looked in the mirror to see, like, well, did you just change or what happened? And, you know, that was the initial response from that information.
Oh, I cannot imagine. I mean, here you are in your mid-30s, so you're
right.
Kind of assuming that at that point in your life you've probably gone through that kind of, who am I in the world? You know, what is my identity?
Right. Well, I think as a result of all of this and as a result of me traveling around the country for 12 years now, which is kind of crazy, telling this story on average 60 to 80 times a year in different kinds of venues, whether it's for high schools or colleges or for corporations and government agencies or for organizations like Literature for All of Us, what I've discovered in the dialogues is that we our identities are fluid, that they're constantly changing. For instance, I'll give you a perfect example of not just that major change in my life, but in the last 2.5 years ago, I got married for the first time in my life. And so now I see myself as a husband.
Yeah, well, congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. But that wasn't a part of my identity for the first 50-some-odd years of my life. So I guess I'm saying is that we don't always acknowledge how our identities are fluid and how they're constantly changing.
On some level, it brings out this sense of how arbitrary it is, you know, how the idea of race is more arbitrary than a parent, you know, something you're assigned to or lived. How did this make you think about your place in the world? I mean, a kind of inherent privilege in being white that you probably never had to look at before, did you?
Right. So what am I now, and how do I come up with this identity? I'm biracial. Am I black? Am I white? So there's a lot of controversy around this because we've been steeped in such a racist history in this country, and because there's just so many ideas, and so many people are so opinionated when it comes to you're black, you're white. For the most part, we've all been given two choices. You're either white or you're black. You're either conservative or a liberal. You're a Democrat or a Republican, good or evil, gay or straight. But there's all kinds of things that exist between those choices, and we don't always acknowledge the breadth of all of those choices or all of those identities, as it were, And I sometimes struggle with the idea of what is my biracial identity. Sometimes I suppose I gravitate more towards my black family. Sometimes I gravitate more towards my white family. Sometimes it's really stark when I see the kinds of privileges and benefits that I have having light skin as opposed to some of my darker skin family members or friends. So it really brings up a lot of issues for me and for audiences when I have this dialogue with them following the show.
Yeah, I understand that's a big part of it, the conversations after the performances.
Right.
Have you noticed them changing in the last year as Black Lives Matter, you know, the protests movement that started a year ago this summer, have triggered?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've been doing this for a long time and really my goal is to get people to engage in a conversation about how we see ourselves and how we look at other people and what is race and stereotypes and all these different things. And I've been noticing, you know, every year my bookings have increased as more and more people want to have this conversation. And it's a really unique way to go about having that conversation. Last year, my bookings were down considerably. And I was really shocked because this was, you know, from Trayvon Martin thing into Eric Gardner and all this stuff. And I struggled to get people to book the show. And people told us, you know, we're really not ready to have this conversation. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. This is 2014, you're not ready to have this conversation. When do you think you will be ready to have this conversation? And then Black Lives Matter took flight and more things happened with Tamir Rice in Cleveland and Michael Brown in Ferguson and, you know, all up through the things that went on in Charles. And now this year, my bookings have kind of gone through the roof.
Interesting. I'm wondering also in those conversations, I have a mixed race friend who says, you know, I often get called to account for not sort of being black enough, you know, that I didn't have that experience. Do you get that from people who don't think you experience life as a black man?
Sure. I have no defense for that. I did not, and I do not have that experience to this day. I am light skinned. Most people see me as white. But that brings out the whole point that there isn't any one black experience. There are many different black experiences, just like there are many different white experiences, many different gay experiences, many different adoptee experiences. And so we need to take that into account when we're having this conversation.
So imagine living your life in a middle-class white neighborhood and finding out in your mid-30s that your biological father is black. That's what happened to my guest, Michael Fosberg, and he's created a one-man play and book called Incognito about the experience. Well, I know that in the play, you know, there's this kind of anger at your mother for not having told you about this, but you kind of work through it. And one of the reviews I read praised the play for being performed without anger, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But now, you know, we're looking at the protests and the movement that erupted after the deaths of, as you mentioned, Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland.
Right.
They were fueled by outrage at injustice. So what role should anger play in this conversation about race in America?
Well, that's a very good question. I am trying not to approach the conversation from a place of anger, and I try to encourage others to do the same, although I completely understand where that comes from and why that exists. What I think happens for a lot of people, especially white people, is that when there's a lot of anger in the room, especially from people of color, they tend to shut down. White people, we tend to shut down when we're in that place. And when we're asked to have a conversation about race, we tend to approach it from a place of caution. Some of us are more cautious than others, but we're cautious because we don't want to say anything that might sound racist or inappropriate or whatever it might be. And we don't want to be jumped on by people of color telling us, you know, how we should think and what we should feel and how racist we are, whatever it might be. And this is part of the problem, is that we're polarized and we don't end up having that conversation. And so what I'm trying to say is it's going to be awkward. It's going to be uncomfortable, but we need to have the conversation, and let's have it from a place of respect.
Well, Michael, this performance is a collaboration with Literature for All of Us and a benefit. It sounds like a really interesting program operating on this kind of book club model with
right.
under-resourced populations. Why are you working with them?
I actually went to a benefit for their organization that was done by a theater group. And there were a couple of different organizations that they had chosen to. All the proceeds from that evening's performance went to a couple of different organizations, and Literature for All of Us was one of those organizations. And when I discovered what they were doing and their mission, I thought, well, how interesting. I wrote this book about my discovery of my African-American, my black roots. And this is what they're trying to do, is to really try to help under-resourced students, teenagers, adults, learn more reading skills and be able to write their stories. And I thought, wow, well, that's what I've done, is I've written my story, and it has to do with race and identity, and that's really what they're trying to promote in these communities. And I thought, what a great thing they're doing, and what a great match for what I'm doing and what they're doing. And I thought, I got to give back. So yes, I make a living doing this, trying to go around the country and get people to engage in conversation, but I got to give back somehow, and I felt like this is a great organization to give to.
Michael, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia. It's a pleasure.
Michael Fosberg, he's an actor, an author, and an activist. His book, Incognito, An American Odyssey of Race and Self-Discovery, and one-man play of the same name, tell the story of a man raised in a white middle-class family, finding out in his mid-30s that his father is African-American. He's performed the show for more than a decade, and it'll be at East West University in Chicago on Sunday. For reviews and clips for the show and more on Michael and Literature for All of Us, you can visit wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Frank Lloyd Wright is probably America's best-known architect. His distinct modernist aesthetic focused on open spaces, transparency, and integration of the built and natural environment. Many of his homes are now museums. Others tend to sell for a premium. Around 270 structures Wright designed for families are still standing, making them valuable and sought-after commodities. Wright designed everything in these public buildings and private homes, down to the household china and doorknobs, which is one of the things that clued in a Wright expert that the home that Linda McQuellen had been living in since 1989 was indeed a Frank Lloyd Wright home, hiding in plain sight for nearly a century. Linda's a math educator living in Madison, Wisconsin, and joins us to tell us more about her now famous house. Linda, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
So how did you come to live in the house?
I was living in a very modern ranch-style house furnished with prairie-style furniture that I had been collecting for many years. And it was time for me to find a house that would fit my furniture. So I contacted a realtor and told her what I was looking for, and told her there was no rush, just see when, if you find a prairie-style home, let me know. And at first, she showed me everything on the market, and so we had to go through and identify what a prairie-style home was, and then I asked her to not call until she found one. About, I think, 3 or 4 years later, I got a call from her just out of the blue saying, I think I found your house. And so I went to look. I didn't bring my son or my husband at the time. I came to look at it, and it had just been put on the market. She opened the door, and I walked in, and I turned around and said, "This is my house. This is the house I want." It was in terrible repair. It needed a lot of work. But it was clear from the minute I saw it that it was the house I wanted.
Well, Prairie Style is a very distinct period of Frank Lloyd Wright's design career and something associated with him. How did this house go undiscovered as Frank Lloyd Wright designed for so long?
I'm not sure personally why that happened. I would never have assumed that a Frank Lloyd Wright house would be on the market in my price range, so I never imagined it was. But I think what threw off the experts was that within the first 10 years of when the house was built, there were two major changes made to it. One was an addition that was put on the back of the house, a two-story addition, and that probably wouldn't have thrown it off, except for the fact that the front porch, which was a very small 9x9 open porch with a cantilevered roof and very characteristic of a Frank Lloyd Wright-style house, that was enclosed. Within 10 years of the house being built, it was changed from a small 9x9 open porch to a much larger enclosed room. They called a sunroom when I bought the house. Mm-hmm. And it was surrounded by a dark brick trim that would never have ever been used by Frank Lloyd Wright.
But I guess the bones of the house still had their appeal. You were attracted to it.
Yes, indeed.
Did you make any changes?
I have totally rebuilt the house, but in the changes that I made, I didn't do any structural changes, no major additions or anything of that nature. We did take out a wall between two bedrooms in the addition that was on the back of the house, and the rest of the work that we did over time involved everything that could possibly be done to a house. We had to re-roof it before we could move in. There was actually a tree growing through the roof of the garage. We rebuilt all the windows. Almost every window in the house was broken. One of the characteristic features of this house is that it has some beautiful leaded glass windows, and most of those windows were in disrepair. Glass was broken, leading was missing, things of that nature. There was a lot of the characteristic Prairie Style trim that had been removed, so we put that back. All of the woodwork was painted. I stripped woodwork to get it down to the natural color. Basically, what I was trying to do was to restore it, to put it back to what it might have looked like without having any information to work on.
That sounds like a lot of work.
It was. And we did it over a period of time. We were finished about 2007, roughly, when the big projects were finished. So it from 89 when we bought it, that's a nice long period of time.
Well, his homes are known for their leaky roofs, often flat roofed. And also he was a very specific, very persnickety designer, known for tiny kitchens and closets, very narrow doorways, very few attic, basement or storage spaces. In fact, Frank Lloyd Wright has been criticized for imposing his will on those who dwell therein. Would you have bought it had you known it was a Frank Lloyd Wright house?
I'm not sure I could have afforded it had I known. But in the condition that it was in and what I was looking for in a home, that would not have made any difference if I could have afforded it, if it had been on the market at a price I could manage. But the point about this type of house is this house was not the kind of house that was designed for a particular owner, where Mr. Wright would have a contract with an owner to design the house to fit that person's lifestyle and would feel that he needed to completely dictate what the furnishings are and all of the touches that make it a livable place. This house is part of a line of homes that he designed called American System Built Homes. They were a combination of interchangeable floor plans. He contracted with builders who could purchase the floor plans from him and put them together to suit whatever building the builder wanted to do. And in my instance, it was a spec home that the builder did without having a client to begin with.
My friend Kelly and her husband, they live in a Rudolf Schindler home. This is in L.A. in the West Side. She's very comfortable there, but she says she really does feel his presence in some kind of way. I wondered if you had that sense of, you know, you are in a place that was made very distinct by a very distinct personality and designer.
Yes. And you know, I didn't feel his presence at the beginning. I felt that his influence was here. I felt that this is clearly a home that was influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright's Prairie Style architecture, which was the early work that he was doing when he was a young man. I could feel that influence, but I guess I didn't give myself permission to connect them to Frank Lloyd Wright. I just felt it was the strength of the design that I loved that was calling to me, this very linear, very open to the world style of architecture. Clearly something spoke to me the minute I opened the door, because I hadn't even seen the whole house yet when I knew this was my space.
Mm. Well, Linda, I think you're going to make a lot of money when you get rid of that house.
I can only hope.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Virginia. Thank you.
Linda McQuillan, she's a math educator. She lives in Madison, Wisconsin, in a home that was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. In fact, it was recently declared to be a Frank Lloyd Wright home, even though she didn't know when she bought it in 1989. You can read more about the discovery at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you play music, does that make you a musician? Or do you have to make a living from your art to be given that title? Day Job is a podcast about how musicians pay the rent, produced by Joshua McNichols. In this episode, we meet Kari Kirkland, who, like many artists, is trying to balance two professional lives.
This is episode 5.
Whatever happens up here, I've got you. Don't worry, I've got you. Do you feel my knuckles in your back? Do you feel my hand around you? Do you feel that? You don't have to think anymore. Just listen. All you have to do is listen. I will take care of the rest.
What do you do in a day?
Well, I teach flying trapeze.
Breathe in the salty air. My heart fills up my ears. Not speaking, just being heard.
As soon as you lean out, you're going to bring the bar up. Okay? You got this. Let's lean out. Lean out with your belly. Lean out to touch my hand. Yep.
Okay. There's a steel bar suspended by two wires, and it is pulled back into the student's hand by a metal hook.
Okay. There we go. Okay, so I want you to lean out, grab that bar. I got you.
I got you.
Lean
out.
Oh, my God. I'm the
lean
one
out and grab that bar.
Height.
So in that moment, they are a spring. They are a spring ready to be released. We say hep, and that's their moment to jump off the platform.
Second hand on, I got you, Stephanie.
You have me?
Yep, I got you.
I don't even know your name.
It's Carrie.
Carrie.
Okay. Hand
just
on the
set.
Bar. Good, push your booty away.
Where do I put my other hand on yours?
Right
yours
next
is?
To Brian.
She's gonna guide you, just listen.
Okay.
Right next to Brian.
And I can pick out the people in my classes who are used to doing jobs that have them be in control. I don't know, you heard me up there with that girl. And yeah, I mean, she works with foster kids and she is in charge of keeping people safe. And so to allow herself to become, in her mind, unsafe and out of control is the most dangerous thing for her to do.
Jump off. Ready?
Okay, wait.
Bend your knees. Hep,
okay,
jump
I can
off.
Do this. I can't do this.
To take that jump, to take that leap off, means they have to let go of everything that's holding them back. And that's why trapeze is so transformative.
Jump!
Jump right!
Ah!
Yeah. Yeah. I've got you. You're doing fantastic.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I'm holding on the rope. Nothing can happen to you. Nice fucking toe. You're doing fantastic. All right, Stephanie, when I say legs, I'm trying to hook your knees, okay?
I don't think so.
You're doing great. Next to me.
hear that woman's voice singing in the background of that song? That's Carrie Kirkland. She composed the song with her friend Seamus. They perform under the name Great and Small. But Seamus always sings the lead. Carrie has a fear of this spotlight.
Honestly, I still struggle with that. I'm a musician who is more comfortable being a flying trapeze instructor than letting someone listen to my music. The other side of that, the funny flip side of that, is like, put me on a karaoke stage, I'll sing all night. I don't care. It's someone else's stuff. But when I put my stuff out there, there's definitely like, oh crap.
That's surprising when you know Carrie's background, because she's the daughter of traveling musicians. As a baby, she slept in a guitar case while her parents crisscrossed Canada from music gig to music gig. But her family wasn't a healthy place to grow up.
My dad has a lot of crazy in him, and he would up and say, okay, we're going here tomorrow. And so you never really knew, am I going to be in school for a while, or am I going to be homeschooled for a while, or is it going to be 2 weeks here, is it going to be 3 days there? It was just hand to mouth. It was literally hand to mouth lifestyle. And it was very difficult.
Carrie left home at age 16. At 19, she formed a band. The band decided to put on a big concert.
I had never performed in front of an audience before.
A music magazine showed up to interview them. The band came out in ridiculous outfits.
I was going to be kind of like Gwen Stefani and have this big wild mane of hair and punky. And I mean, there was nothing good about it at all.
But the people in the audience were their friends, and so they cheered when the band came out on stage. And then they sat back and witnessed one of the worst train wrecks of a performance any of them had ever seen.
And nothing's tight. And I sang so quietly that, you know, the mic was so hot that it was feeding back.
The guitarist seemed to think he was some kind of guitar god.
We looked around and you see in the eyes of all of your bandmates on stage going, Jesus, this is not good. This is not good. And therefore, everybody starts to melt a little bit. And they're like, oh, God, just get through it, please.
The audience grew more and more quiet.
And then by the end of the second or third song, it's like... it's terrible.
Her mom had come out to see the show. She tried to offer Carrie some emotional support, but Carrie had already made up her mind about the performance.
Oh, God, I watched the video of it afterwards, and I actually stepped on the video and burned it. Like, I got rid of it because I didn't want anybody to ever see it again. It was so bad.
Leave the dying sun behind. It fades to the distance. I look towards the place that I left with such resistance. The wind is howling from the west. I turned to face a fury. I didn't come to find myself. I gave myself to bury. Empty hallways, full of doors. Love and life in corner stores. Silence where we used to find voices of another kind. I'd change it if I could. I'd change the days we didn't speak and keep the ones we were.
That performance was a long time ago, but Carrie still remembers clearly how afraid she felt when everything spiraled out of her control. That knowledge makes Carrie an empathetic trapeze instructor.
Some people who instruct are all about the business of, you know, let's get them hooked in, let's get them off the platform, because that leaves them the least amount of time to be afraid. And I subscribe to that, and at the same time, for me, I prefer people to walk through that fear rather than around it. So I tend to have people up on the board with me a little bit longer. I like to let them take a breath. I like them to feel how high they are.
Stay right there. Doing great. Yeah, you're doing awesome.
Hey, honey, this is nerve-wracking. You're going to be holding on to me when I leave.
I have got you right now, okay? Do you feel my knuckles in your back?
Sometimes words get stuck, and it seems I'm far away. But I've got so much on my mind, and so much more to say.
Kerry got married recently to the founder of Emerald City Trapeze Arts.
And we flew before the wedding. Gary, my husband, caught me. I flew in a tiny little white tutu. It was rhinestones and blinged out. It was amazing.
Kerry says it's been good to be near someone who sees her potential. She says he challenges her, reminds her it's okay to take risks. And she's learning, slowly, to accept his praise. At the end of our interview, Kerry let me strap a microphone to her arm with duct tape. Then she climbed the ladder, grabbed the bar, stepped off the platform, and flew.
Stone the crows, we rode the coaster, overloaded, jumped the rail.
Daydub is produced by Joshua McNichols. There's a link to more episodes of the podcast at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What better activity on a beautiful fall day than pulling on a scarf and heading out to the orchard to pick buckets of apples? Then come the pies or the sauces, or eating them straight, undoubtedly evoking memories of perfect autumn days past. It's a rite of passage for many children, certainly, but Daniel Gross shatters that illusion in his article decrying apple picking as a scam. And he has a point. What other fruit would you pay a markup on to go pick much more than you could possibly use yourself? Daniel Gross is a longtime contributor to Slate. His most recent book is Better, Stronger, Faster. Daniel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good to be here.
Have you been apple picking recently?
Yes, I have. I should admit that that article that you're referring to was first published in 2006, and Slate republishes it every fall to fresh outrage and fresh traffic. And, you know, at the time, my kids were 7 and 4, and that was a thing you really did with kids of that age. And for several years thereafter, pretty much every fall, we would go apple picking, whether it was an orchard close to our home in Connecticut or in the Berkshires or somewhere in upstate New York. So, yes, I am a repeat, a recidivist apple picker.
Well, I don't think people go apple picking because it's the cheapest option. So you've got to acknowledge there is an experiential reason to go to the orchards, right?
Yeah, I mean, I look at this as, you know, through the lens of I'm a business and economics reporter. And so the business and economics surrounding apple picking and the issue of providing your own labor, you know, that was what sort of got me thinking about the sort of broader aspect of it. Of course, you do it for the experience, and you are paying for the experience of being out in nature and doing something that all sorts of people used to do in the earlier 20th century and the 19th century for sure, which was raise and grow some of their own food and pick it themselves. Of course, we have gone a long way from that, and comparatively few of us are actually engaged in that in our normal life. And so that's why the prospect of going to pick your own apples, I think, has a lot of appeal. And it's something, you know, we all want our kids to eat more healthy, and there's something about having your kid pick that piece of fruit off the tree and bite into it that makes it more appealing to them as well. So there is definitely, you know, an experiential upside. What I question is the sort of financial or business or economic upside that you get from this.
Okay, break it down. How big is that difference, the financial upside?
Well, it's substantial. I mean, when you go buy, you know, it's not just that you are paying more on a per pound basis. And, you know, let's face it, apples, like everything else, are produced on an industrial basis. We have agriculture has become very industrialized. They are very efficient. They do it in very large quantities. And that's why, you know, whether it's berries or cucumbers or lettuce or apples, it's generally cheaper to buy it through the industrial complex than it is through an artisan. We just have these systems of trucking and shipping and distributing that gets it to the grocery store more cheaply than someone working on their own does. So, in effect, you are paying more per pound to get them in the field, and you're also doing the labor. But I think the other thing that inevitably happens when you pick your own apples is that you buy a lot more than you can consume. Hmm. Right? You're there and you get a big bag and you buy several pounds. Whereas if you were going to the grocery store, you would buy five or six, and if one of them went bad, okay, so be it. You tend to buy smaller quantities. The experience of picking your own apple encourages you. You know, each kid gets their own bucket, and you get a bucket, and you fill it up, and then you come home and you realize you have 95 apples for three people, and that only two of them actually eat them. So it does encourage overconsumption, which is kind of wasteful.
Well, in addition to your economic lens, there's a lens of botany or biology here, pointing out that the trees are not really naturally growing in this experience that's presented as a visit to nature.
Sure. The example I use, there's a farm near my house in Connecticut called Silverman's Farms in Easton, Connecticut, and it's really all designed around the sort of child's experience. On one side of the road, they have a kind of petting zoo, and then on the other side of the road are the apple trees and the orchards. And the trees have all been bred to be extremely short so that 5 and 6 year old can reach them. And when you kind of look at it from a distance, these are not majestic, mature apple trees sort of rising up to the sun. They look kind of gnarled and hunched over as if they had been kind of, penned in so that they could serve the target audience more effectively. These are the veal calves of the tree world.
Okay, but we are in New England. You grew up in Michigan. We have a place in Connecticut. Isn't there something to be said for just the nostalgia, the beauty of the apple picking experience with the family?
Yeah, this is part of our collective heritage as New Englanders, as people from upstate New York, where I went to college, as Midwesterners. It's the onset of the football season. It's the leaves changing color. It's pumpkins. It's that crisp feeling in the air. This is all part of it. This is part of the rhythm of the life in this part of the country, and I don't think it's something we should dispense with. I think it should be embraced, but I think we should go into it with clear eyes and recognize some of the excesses and inefficiencies that are involved.
Well, Daniel, thank you very much for speaking with us.
I'm happy to do it.
Daniel Gross, he is a longtime contributor to Slate, and like the apples, like the pumpkins, his article about the scam that is apple picking comes around each autumn. His most recent book is called Better, Stronger, Faster. You'll find a link to more, including a link to read his article at wordofmouthradio.org.
It's apple picking season. Where did you hide? Standing in your orchard, oh, apple of my eye.
About 25 years ago, right around this time, a new tradition was being created in Keene, New Hampshire.
While pumpkins may put Keene, New Hampshire into the Guinness Book of World Records, a local resident is asking everyone to bring a lit pumpkin to the downtown area tonight.
She's hoping more than 1,000 jack-o'-lanterns will be on display. There's no record for lit pumpkins in the Guinness Book of World Records, but Keene hopes to be the first.
In 1992, Keene was the first, with 1,628 pumpkins. It was the launch of the Keene Pumpkin Festival, which grew into an annual tradition. Keene did not hold the record each year, but by 2013 had collected an all-time high of 30,851 pumpkins. After riots broke out at Keene State College during last year's Pumpkin Festival, the city voted not to host the event in 2015. So for the first time in 25 years, Main Street in Keene will be relatively dark this weekend. Producer Megan Tan took a walk around downtown Keene to ask residents how they were feeling about the absence of the festival.
What are your feelings towards it?
I love the thing, the whole show. I could come out anytime I want, walk around, and it's sad that it's not going to be here. It doesn't seem like October without it.
It was wonderful. It was just a nice slice of Americana.
I think it's sad. I think it's very sad because it was such a wonderful family event. We would bring our children up, and our friends would all come up, and we'd spend the night in Keene and come to the festival, and it was wonderful.
It definitely sucks that it's not here anymore. It was always fun to go to. I liked.
This year, they won't see the giant pumpkin tower at the head of the square. They won't attend the pumpkin seed spitting contests or eat fried dough. And local businesses won't see the big influx of tourist dollars either.
I'm a little nervous about this year. This will be my third year working in Keene, and both years I kind of banked on making money during Pumpkin Festival.
But not everyone shares those rosy sentiments.
I'm not sad to see it go. It got too crowded. It's like a Yogi Berra thing. It became too popular, and nobody wanted to stay here for it, at least in town anyway.
I feel, you know, kind of mixed feelings, because I have been an attendee of Pumpkin Festival since I was, like, a toddler. So I was kind of sad, but then I have high hopes for the Monadnock Pumpkin Festival in Swansea. You know,
the Keene Pumpkin Festival may be over, or at least on hiatus, but this weekend some New Hampshire towns will try to fill the void. Like in downtown Laconia, they'll be having a pumpkin festival which will have a tower of pumpkins, and they're also aiming for a new world record for the most lit pumpkins in one place. And also this Saturday, the Monadnock Pumpkin Festival will have its debut in Swansea.
And I think this festival, the Monadnock Pumpkin Festival that they're putting together, could be the new iteration of the Pumpkin Festival that will work better for the community.
When I talked to people in Keene and asked them about their plans, some people were unsure about what they were going to do.
Probably just hanging out with friends. Maybe going to, I heard there's going to be one like a town over or something, so maybe I'll go see that.
And so this year you're going to be?
Probably in town.
Doing nothing.
I live on the seacoast now. So we'll be staying down there and missing the Pumpkin Festival, unfortunately.
Hopefully this will be the only year that we take a break. And then next year we'll be like, okay, let's try this again and let's have a little bit more boundaries, because I think it's really important to this town and to everybody else around New Hampshire. People visit from all over.
I think it's safe to say that everyone is curious to see if these solutions will be the new tradition, or if things will return back to Keene, where the Pumpkin Festival was created 25 years ago.
A new benchmark for the Guinness World Book of Records, and the number is 1,628.
Only time will tell. The voices that you heard were from...
My name is Nicole Perry.
Cassie. Kathy Latchoff.
Mark Ryan?
Yep.
Okay.
Trevor Reno.
Alexandria Harris.
Joe Hoppick.
Thank you so much, Joe.
All right, thanks.
And I'm Megan Tan for Word of Mouth.
We're so grateful for your listening time today, and there is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of the show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend, or better yet, write a review. It will help others find the podcast more easily and uses the tried and true method of spreading information via word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.